This is Rio 2, the Baptist Church, McIntosh and Lois Dixon. Baptist Church, McIntosh and Lois Dixon. Although it's turning out to be mostly Lois Dixon, Rio 2. Rio 2. Lois Dixon, Rio 2. Channel 1 right. This is Channel 1 right and a continuation of the talk with Lois Dixon. About supper time, Friday the 20th of June, 69. A continuation from the last reel after talk with Lois Dixon about supper time on Friday the 20th of June, 69. And this is Channel 1 right of the new reel, the Baptist Church, McIntosh and Lois Dixon.
I just saw that thing. Adam's blessing. They've been in a wedding down in Over Citra.
Oh.
And you know how one thing leads on to another? Then I was asking, I thought those Gibson boys paint, and I bet they like to have some work. I bet they like to make some money.
This boy.
Oh, really?
My uncles were just a scream. They were just like Will Rogers. They were so funny.
Your uncles?
My uncles.
Now, Uncle George?
And see, then he went to live with those Uncle Bill and them. So when they both died, then he bought himself a little place up there.
Now, Uncle George would be on your...
He's my mother's sister. He's my mother's brother.
Mother's brother.
And he was a bachelor.
Yeah.
And so he took his money and bought that 10-acre farm.
Yeah.
And the neighbors, it was kind of in that neighborhood. And the people who lived over there were just pickle pink. That's always the grandest thing, to have this bachelor come live in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they just fed him.
Oh, really?
You know, they would cook the vegetables and the stuff in there and send down there to him.
Yeah.
So he just lived like royalty up there in the summertime.
Yeah.
Then he'd come down here in the winter.
Oh, really?
And stay with us. Then my mother died, while he would stay until school was out, and I'd drive him back and come down, going on to New York. He'd come down here long around Thanksgiving time. He'd drive that far. I'd go up on the train and drive him back. And we just had the best time. And then about 3 years before he died, another brother, Uncle John Willingham, lost his wife. They had no children. So Uncle John used to come down here the one. I had both the uncles
for about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then Uncle George died. Uncle George died at Dr. Stranger's Hospital over here,
mm-hmm,
at the age of 75. And then Uncle John kept coming down here in the winter. And in the summer, he'd go over. He sold his place there in Kennesaw, Georgia. And he spent his summers with these girls in South Carolina. He'd come to here the one time. Well, Uncle John lived to be 85.
Mm-hmm.
And he died in South Carolina.
But now, they were wits.
They were wits.
They had a fine sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, kind of how would it do?
I don't know. They would just make fun. Just make fun out of anything. I don't know that can... think of anything right now, but they were lots of fun.
Yeah. Now, when they were down here...
My Uncle John always said the blessing at the table at home, at his own home. And we had, we had people who have always had blessing at the
table.
Now,
wait just a minute.
They like it that way, to see.
He said blessing at the table.
Uh-huh, but when he came down here, he wouldn't say it down here. Well, I said... Now, I've been used to a man saying the blessing at the table. My father always said the blessing, and Uncle George said the blessing. So I said, I'll get you a book, and you can read it, if you're timid to that extent.
He wasn't timid.
So I got a little book of blessing, one for every day. I use it now, too. But there was some, once in a while, there comes a blessing there where it said, bless this food. To have perishing bodies. But that would tickle him so easily. The meeting would break up. With a big laugh. That was a funny way to express a blessing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
This is food to our perishing bodies. And that just killed
me. He couldn't get through it.
He couldn't get through it. And we just had to quit.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
yeah.
He could just say things.
Well, let me tell you.
I think I had a quicker wit than Uncle George even, but they were good company.
Yeah.
And they used to love to play Chinese checkers.
Oh.
I play Chinese checkers. I used to hold the night. They played the life out of me with these Chinese checkers.
Oh.
They ran at the ground. And Uncle John knew that sometimes I was getting tired. I couldn't help but show it.
Yeah.
And because he beat me. I didn't enjoy because he beat me every time.
Yeah.
And so he'd know that I was getting tired of it and wasn't enjoying it anymore. But he didn't pay attention.
Yeah.
And so we'd finish the game and he'd won it, you know.
Yeah.
He'd turn the board. Now they would play some checkers. Like we hadn't been playing for 2 hours. Now they were. That particular so, you know, that I couldn't be mad for long because he was so funny to me.
Now, did your family always impose on you like that?
Well, I don't know that they would call that an imposition, but I didn't consider it an imposition.
No.
But I thought it was a little unreasonable, but they make me play until my pupils would come.
Oh.
And I liked to play a little while before, not to go from the checkerboard right to the piano.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I thought they put it over on the checker.
Yeah. Now, there's Uncle George and
Uncle
John.
Mm-hmm.
And Uncle George died first at 75.
Mm-hmm.
And Uncle John, old too?
Uncle John died at 85.
Yes. And they'd come down here in the winters.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Each one of them had a car.
Yeah.
We had 3 cars out in the yard.
Oh, really? Now, that was as late as the 30s? No, the 20s.
No, that was the latest. That's later than that. Uncle George died in 1950, and Uncle John died in 1959.
Oh, really?
I haven't.
Well, you've had a family then, right?
Yes,
up until...
Yes, I know I have. Mm-hmm.
Well, gee whiz. Yes.
Yeah, I know a lot about taking care of old men.
Yeah. Yes. Well, now that makes a difference when you got a family like that, and you care the household. Oh, yeah. Goodness, this old house seen a lot of people, hasn't it?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Had a lot of customers.
Mm-hmm.
How would you say that Mrs. Crosby Adams influenced you most as a teacher? Well, I know it's a big question, but I mean, kind of.
Well, I think personality-wise, I don't know so much about the teaching material and about the technique of the piano or of teaching pedagogically, but I think just her personality.
Yeah. Now, her personality, now, kind of how you associate that?
Well, her students all... Well, they looked up to her, so they thought that she'd had such a wonderful background, such a fine, so many wonderful experiences with the people of a big name, because she was a big name person, too.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I just thought, well, if I could, in my little way, in this little community, and among my pupils, if I could exalt myself a little bit to them, be to them kind of like I felt, if they kind of feel toward me like I felt like Ms. toward Ms. Adams. And I came home and I tried to have my books out here. Unconsciously, I realized that I was kind of imitating, trying to imitate Mrs. Adams. That's the way I mean by she.
Well, you're right. Ms. Adams, now she knew you. That's what she had in mind when she taught you all. Was that you would be outstanding in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what she had in mind, wasn't it?
And she felt like, and she said it in almost so many words, she felt that we must be the representative teachers in our community, as we wouldn't be there.
Yeah. Yes. So, in a way, she was sort of underpinning the community, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, the sad thing to me.
Well, the nicest experience that ever came my way came through Ms. Adams. she had a pupil in Asheville, North Carolina, Asheville, Helen Pugh, P-U-G-H, Pugh. Her father was a doctor in Asheville. And she's a very brilliant concert pianist, is Helen Pugh. And she was playing with the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra. And they were to give a concert in Ormond Beach, at the Ormond Beach Hotel. And now let me see if I get this straight. Some rich woman was sponsoring Helen Pugh in her career, and she arranged for this concert down here at Ormond Beach. And the invitation, you could only attend by invitation, and the invitations were engraved. And she wrote, Mrs. Crosby Adams wrote this woman, and said, I wish you would invite a former pupil of mine, Lois Dixon from McIntyre. So I got this engraved invitation to attend this concert at Ormond Beach Hotel to hear Helen Pugh. She was playing the Grieg A Minor Concerto with the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra. And so I went. And it took me all day to get there. That was before the days when you would get in your car, mm-hmm. A woman would get in the car and drive it home to beach. I got on the bus here. I went to Gainesville. I went to Palatka and I changed. Then I went down to the land and changed. And finally got to the phone. It took all day. Okay. And Marguerite Porter, who used to be a music teacher in Ocala and was James Melton's first voice teacher, lived in Daytona at that time, and I had known her. So I wrote her and asked her if I could back some Latin. I had this invitation. So I spent the night with Marguerite Porter and got a taxi. She didn't have a car. I got a taxi and went to the Ormond Beach Hotel to the thing. And all the Rockefellers were there. John Dean, his granddaughter Matilda McCormick, and all those kind of people. And I just felt like I was up on cloud nine going with this engraved invitation to this concert, and all of them because I had, was a student of Ms. Adams. And then I left the taxi, came back in my reporter the next day. I met all that way again with the bus coming home the next day. But that was quite an experience.
Oh, yeah.
I was quite young at that, and back in
the day. Now, when was that, the 20s?
Yes, I guess it was. And, you know, I found that program here not long ago somewhere, if I looked at the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Of Helen T.
What kind of household did you all have when your mother and your father were thriving? How big a household did you have? Just now, was your sister here very long?
Yes, I'm 9.5 years older, my sister.
Oh.
And by the time she was ready to go to school over here, I was ready to go to school somewhere else.
Yeah.
And by the time I came back then, these schools had gotten so sorry here. We had a few years where we had very poor school system here. And so they put her in school up in Gainesville, and Miss Keebles.
Yeah.
Is on a private, on a boarding school around here.
Uh-huh.
At that time. So she went there to school, and then she went to Norman Park, Georgia, which was a Baptist kind of a junior college. Then she went to Southern College.
Uh-huh.
Down in Lakeland. We had an uncle, my father's only brother lived in Lakeland.
Uh-huh.
So they were inclined to down that way. And then she got a teaching at Miss Thibault. And by that time she was
big. I taught at Miss Thibault.
Uh-huh. To take some science. Yeah. And that's where she met her husband.
Yeah.
He was down here. He was especially interested in tunnel.
Oh, yes. Oh, I've seen some of those big old tongue orchards. They're beautiful.
But that, the tunnel business, didn't prove to have the future that they thought it was going to have. He came here from MIT, and he was interested in varnishes and paints and things like that. And mm-hmm. he wanted to study about this, and thought it was the only tongue operation state in the union.
Mm-hmm.
So he came down here for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out not to have the trick that thought it was going to have, so he went back to his first love, which was photographic chemistry.
Oh.
And in time, of course, found his way to Eastman. And
yeah.
He was quite a pioneer in color photography.
Oh.
He had a fellow named Howard Colson and Neblett, Mr. Neblett, Carl Neblett. Those three men wrote some textbooks on photographic chemistry. Until that time, every photographic student had to take all the course in chemistry there was to get a little bit in their course that had to do with photographic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
But these three men, my brother-in-law and two others, wrote the first textbook on photographic chemistry.
Ms. Crosby Adams, you know, I don't think of the children who would study, including you up there at school, as really becoming professional musicians. I somehow just can't hardly see that. And it's the university or the big schools where they have to major in music, you know, and give up the literary courses. I can't quite see that. I think
what the music does is...
I'm not telling what's right. I'm just telling my own feeling. That, I don't know how to say it. I never really thought it out, but it's something that will make you a better citizen and make you enjoy things more. What would you say? Just enrich your life or something like that?
Well, music that exalts life, in other words.
Yes. Yeah.
That motto that I have been so impressed by and have been more or less guided by it.
Yeah.
Music study exalts life.
Yeah. Well, now, do you see it a little bit like that?
Mm-hmm. I haven't had very many pupils who play very well, certainly not any that play brilliantly, but I have lots of people who play for churches and play for programs like that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my great satisfactions is that a young man who now has a drugstore in Lakeland has five children.
Mm-hmm.
Used to take music here. They struggled and learned to play a little bit. And every time I see Tommy Burry, he said, "Miss Lois, I can't play the music. I can't play the music." But he said, I enjoy thinking about my music study.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate music
mm-hmm.
more. And I can listen to it with more intelligence because I have studied it.
Yeah.
And he said, "I'd love to be able to sit down and play, but I can't. I just can't play the music." He always said, "I can't play the music." That's the way he always expresses it.
Yeah.
But says, "I bought a piano and have all five of my children study music.
Yes,
whether
right.
they ever learn to play or not, I want to study music.
Yeah.
I play brilliantly. I want to learn." But you know, that's been a great satisfaction and comfort for me.
Oh, I should think so.
And sometimes people, parents think, "Oh, the money is thrown away on music." Well, I don't think it's thrown away.
Yeah.
They may not be able to sit down and play like that Faye Miles can play.
Yeah.
But if they have exalted their life, given a little greater appreciation,
yeah.
music is one of the fine arts. If they've
yeah.
come
yeah.
To have more appreciation for the finer things of life, then I don't think it's wasted.
Well, now through the music, they actually get acquainted with people you knew,
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
Ms. Adams and the German,
the Italian man.
It's a broadening influence, and if they can learn to play and...
And you talk to them about the musicians,
mm-hmm.
their personal... The men, as men, don't you?
And I like to talk to them more about it, but I only see them half an hour a week. It's wonderful to learn anything. Now, just think about that.
Half hour a week?
Now, when I went to school, I had two private piano lessons a week.
Mm-hmm.
I had 2 hour lessons of harmony a week, 2 hour lessons of theory a week, 2 hour lessons of musical history a week.
Yeah.
I belonged to a music appreciation class and a music club. I was exposed to all kinds of music.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I try to crowd into 1 half hour a week
yeah.
a little bit of all of that.
Because
that's all they're going to get. Well, public school does give them a little bit of music appreciation, public school music,
uh-huh.
in class form.
Uh-huh.
But I would love to be able to see them twice a week. Once they have the piano and once for history and
for theory and
for just general music information. But I tried to get it all, a little bit of it all in that one time.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine stopped by a boy I used to know in school. He lives in New York now. He belongs to the Metropolitan Opera Society. He said, "Of all things I belong to, I'm proud of that thing."
Yeah.
And he's made a big name for himself in the way of finding. He's a trustee of Stetson.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he stopped by here one time, and he wanted to know his interest in my music, what I did and that. And he asked me all kinds of questions about it. He said, "Will you kindly tell me what you think you can teach a child in half an hour of music once a week?" Well, I said, "You'd be surprised, you know. I'm going to defend myself. You'd be surprised how much the children learn and how well they do play when I have my little program. You'd be surprised. It does sound, well," he says, it's just next to nothing. I said, "Yes, but it's a little better than nothing."
Mm-hmm.
But he was used to more music study, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it has come to that now. Almost all of them, everywhere, they just have a half hour lesson once a week.
After school?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
After they get home from a long day in
yes,
school?
Yes, and I see them when they're worn out.
Yeah. That's what Faye complains about. But what do you complain about?
What do you mean? Complaining about what? About life generally?
Well, you haven't, I've been talking to you, you haven't complained about anything much. You just never complain?
Well, I don't know. I have two pet peeves, I guess. Pick up your children when they're through. I can't babysit and give music lessons at the same time. And that's what advanced do.
Now, they not used to rockers.
No.
Now, they'll just rock away
mm-hmm.
out here.
And then that one there, they'll go over and they swing and they make noises with the swing. And I'm afraid they'll get hurt.
Well, now you see.
And inclusive, I'm going to say to people when they come and want the children to take music lessons, I'm going to say I have be obliged to limit the class to those who have a prompt transportation.
Mm-hmm.
When they're through the lesson, I want to go.
Yeah. I can understand that.
Now, this is the end of this little tape. It's such a poor tape, my battery gave out. And I'm having to transfer it with an old battery. If I use a new battery, or even if I use this plug to the AC current, it makes it go too fast. So this is the end of this tape on Friday, about supper time, the 20th of June, 69. We general talk about the people, mostly, with Lois Dixon. It started on the last reel, now it's on reel 2, and this is channel 1, 255.
Good afternoon.
How you doing?
Why don't you turn a somersault out in public sometime?
I'd rather mash my nose than turn a somersault.
You know, Lois, I've been talking to, Flora, I've been talking to Lois a minute. She hasn't said a word about her mom and papa. What'd he do?
He had a store in McIntosh right down there. You know where the little house is, back of her house there? And when we married, there was a store there, and Mr. Quarterman was still living. And I think at one time, Mr. Dixon was in with Mr. Christian.
Oh.
I believe, now I'm not positive, because you see, he wasn't living when I married. But I don't know whether he was ever with Mr. Christian or not, but he had a store right back of the house there, facing the street down there, the post office street.
Oh, you mean Mr. Dixon died before you came to this country?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, gee whiz, he didn't live long.
Now, I don't know just how, but Ms. Dixon, I remember her quite pleasantly.
She lived till 1940.
1940, I didn't remember. See, that was 7 years after we married, so, I knew her, but,
Did he have money to spend?
Money to spend?
To spend?
Well, he didn't spend too much of it, I don't imagine.
Yeah.
He was a very thrifty person, they said.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he ever made much, but I think he was pretty thrifty.
Oh, you didn't know him?
No.
Well, I keep asking about him.
Uh-huh.
What is she like?
Who, Lois?
No, Ms. Her mother.
I never remember too much about her. She was very, they were very nice people, and she was very, I just don't remember enough about it to playing.
But did she have, is she the one who collected all that furniture? Lois just added a little piece here and there.
I didn't know I just didn't know who had the furniture. I know that the wife of one of her uncles, I think, had some of it. They called her Aunt May, I believe.
Wait.
Willingham were her uncles.
Yeah, that was her mother's two brothers.
That's right.
Now, George wasn't married.
No, he wasn't married.
You knew him?
Yes, I knew Uncle George and Uncle Jumbo.
What were they like?
They were just, Uncle John was more of a businessman than Uncle George. I don't know too much about him. Of course, they just lived with Lois, you know, some. Uncle John didn't live with her as much as Uncle George. But they were just good, pleasant people, you know.
Sturdy, everyday like people.
Yes,
Uncle George was a bachelor.
Yes, But he wasn't the businessman that Uncle John was. Uncle John, no. Well, he was married, and he had a child, I believe one child. And he was just, he mixed and mingled. And he might have been a little more reserved than Uncle George. I don't remember too much about him.
That goes way back. Well, he lived till 1959.
Uncle John. Yes, I knew him. Knew all about him, and I know Lois's cousins too. She has two cousins who are still living.
Now, after her mother died, did she take over the household?
Well, no. She and her mother lived there alone, and then she has a sister in New York.
Yes.
New York State, and I think they own the home together.
Yeah.
But of course, Lois will have it as long as she lives, you know. And then I imagine it go to Lucille.
Well, now, after her mother died, she just took it all over.
Well, she just continued to live there by herself.
Now, she took care of the two uncles?
No, she didn't have to take care of them. They just would visit her. I think Uncle John came there in the wintertime, perhaps. I don't remember too much about it, but I don't think that they were dependent on her at all.
Yeah.
Financially.
No, but when they were there, she cooked for them?
Yes. She looked after them when they were sick. She waited on them.
Did she have any help?
I don't know if she ever had too much help.
Well, back that early, help was available.
She used to have a yard man, and he lived in the yard there in a little house, and it burned once. I remember how he looked. And it burned, and he burned in it. And that was quite an episode in her life. I mean, they think he fell in the fire or something, you know.
Oh, my.
But that was...
Right there on the place.
Right on the place, right. I don't know just where the house stood. It was back there near the garage, I expect. But Lois is a very interesting person.
She has so many gifts, hasn't she?
Yes, Mercy. I was telling Martin today I'd have to take care of all that stuff. But, you know, she has many friends and many pupils, and people go off and they bring her things. And she's good to everybody, and everybody tries to be good to her, I think.
Yeah.
But she does. But I don't think she has what you call a lot of antiques or anything like that. She's like me. She might have a few pieces of old furniture, but there's nothing there that anybody could steal and be wealthy from, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about those things, I don't think.
Flora, do you know some of her teachers? She talks about her teachers to the children.
I never did know them. I told Faye this morning I felt like I knew Ms. Adams. Wasn't that who it is?
Oh, she's the one who was at Montreat.
Yeah, the one, Oh, well, she, I remember she used to write to, I think she's died within the time I've known Lois, I feel like she has.
Uh-huh.
The one named Adams, but I never did know any of those people.
Miss Crosby Adams, I mean through Lois.
Uh-huh, that's the only way.
Well, what are they, how does she come through to you through Lois? How does she impress you?
To speak very lovingly of her, you know.
Yeah.
And she has quite a high respect for people like that in that regard. Mm-hmm. Lois is a very appreciative person.
Yeah.
She's, she appreciates people and their interests and things like that. And I think she kept in touch with Miss Adams.
Flo, how long has Lois been active in the church?
Her church? I expect all her life. I don't know.
Ever since you can remember?
Ever since I've known her. That's been 36 years.
And she's played and directed and all?
And I don't know just how much she directs the singing or anything. I don't think she directs the choir, but she has played and then she has taught class, you see. I don't know how long she's taught a class. But I bet you one thing, I bet you she's prepared and I bet she presents a good lesson. I never have been in a class, not even to visit it. But I know I've heard once she referred to a book she liked to have or something. I don't know just what it was. Well, I got it for her. She didn't realize I was going to get it. But she just appreciates anything anyone gives her and she refers to it, you know, and I know this one book, and she's told me at different times how many lessons she's gotten, you know, inspiration from it. So she does a lot of research and a good bit of reading.
Yeah.
And living alone, she doesn't have the interruptions that some other people have, you know. And she...
Well, I'm not too sure of that.
Well, she doesn't.
When I was sitting down there on the front porch talking to her, the telephone rang about 6 times.
Well, I mean, she has a lot of friends, but she gets up early, and she does her housework before some of us are ever up, you know.
Oh, does she?
And things like that, and if she wakes up, she's like my sister. She gets up when she wants to, and she eats when she wants to. But, of course, during the day, she does have a lot of friends to talk to on the telephone. She doesn't. She doesn't go, well, she goes too, but anyway, she has plenty of time to study and plenty of time to clean her house, because she doesn't have any help whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
Never.
Oh, me. How would the community get along without a few people like that, huh?
Well, I don't know, Guy, but she means so much to the sick people and to the older people.
Yeah.
She's always been kind to older people. That's my idea. I've known people that couldn't get to the post office, and she, you know, takes some things. But she just goes. Someone said, how do you know what she does without her telling you? And I said, well, she doesn't tell me everything she does. Sometimes she'll say, well, I ran so-and-so and took them a quarter orange juice I squeezed. You know, well, she's not bragging on what she did, but she means she contacted that person, you know, and saw them and was interested in them. So, you know, someone else that doesn't do anything, they just wonder how I find out what Lois does, you know.
Yeah.
I kind of throw it up to some of the rest of them sometimes what she does. And she has friends that never do anything, you know, and things like that. And so they wonder how I know what Lois does. But
yeah.
I do know, but I know she loves people. She's going to spend Monday and Tuesday night with Charlotte Orwell in Atlanta. I don't know whether Faye understood that or not.
Oh, really?
I didn't tell Faye, but she got her plane ticket to New York with the reservation that she could stop off in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
And so she'll stop off there around noon Monday.
Uh-huh.
And then Charlotte put her back on the plane Wednesday.
Oh, that'd be nice. And
so she has a friend in Atlanta that her mother and this friend were married at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Double wedding. And the friend named a child for her mother. Mm-hmm. And then this woman's daughter named the child for Lois.
Mm-hmm.
So they have never met since they've been grown. So I don't think they live too far from Charlotte. So they're going to have Lois for lunch on Tuesday. So Lois will get to see them. And she has one or two other relatives in Atlanta that she'll call them. I don't know whether she'll get to see them or not. But she's very fond of our girls, and they are of her. We often think that we see a good bit of Lois in Charlotte, especially the way she plays the piano and things like that.
Well,
more than we do in Alice. But they're different personalities,
Are you taking care of yourself?
Huh? Yeah, I sure am.
Are you going to be back in circulation someday?
Now, this is Flora Richardson. We talked about Lois from Channel 1 right to 250 to 440. This is Saturday, the 21st of June, 69, after dinner, after lunch. They checked in on Flora, and they talked a good bit, and she got nice comments, but these are not so nice. Some of them are right interesting. And this is Channel 1 right at the end of the little telephone conversation with Flora around 4:40, Channel 1 right, Saturday, the 21st of June, 69. Now, this is the end of the talk with Lois Dixon on Sunday afternoon. After that marvelous tape on Saturday, some extra comments, no great lift, but interesting. I put them after the fine tape on Channel 1 over, and I'm finishing them out on this Channel 1 right after the telephone conversation with Flora. This is a talk with Lois, continuation of it, the end of it, on Sunday afternoon after church, the 22nd of June, 69, and this is Channel 1 right. Channel 1 right, about 460 now. 1980.
Oh, well, no, not all of them, but I mean, I have some that are dated 1980. And the reason why I happen to have them is, during the World War II, President Roosevelt had scrap paper drive. Was it something scrap paper? Well, the Civic League, over here, of which I was president at that time, sponsored the collection of scrap paper in this area. So we sent out a great call, and I made a lot of announcements about scrap paper. And my Uncle George was here. I said, bring it all here. And Uncle George's job then was you bailed it up and tied it aside a certain way and took it into Ocala to the collection part. Well, I urged people to go to the attic, go everywhere where they had scrap paper. We want to be patriotic. The president said, collect scrap paper. So that's what we're going to do. So Mrs. J.K. Christian, who lived in this big house on the highway, she went up her attic, and she brought down all those magazines and things she had up there, brought them down here. Well, I happened to be with Uncle George the day that we were tying up that bottle. And here were all these issues. Well, I said, so help me, the president said, scrap paper. This is not scrap paper.
So it's literature.
I can give you the scrap paper drive. So I took them all out. And I phoned Miss Christian. I tell her what I'm going to do. I don't want to sell those issues scrap paper. And your permission, I'm going to put them in my library of music. She said, well, that's all right. She doesn't want to get them out of the way. She didn't care for them. Well, I said, they're valuable to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have since lost some of those in another unusual way. I go out there every now and then to go through and to clean up and remove the dead roaches and things and spider webs. And Charlotte Richardson, several times while she was in school, was asked to prepare paper on some subject or other. She was given a choice, and she often selected a music subject. Then she'd write me and ask me if I could help her with some get up some notes on this. She knew I had got many books, and she knew I had all those. And I'd go out there, I'd spend all morning going through looking through the index to find something that might help about Charlotte and her subject. Well, I was out there one day looking at something, and I ran into these bed of ants, these great big ants.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, just in a minute, they were just all over me, all over me, just all over everything, all over those books. And it was just, I was just in a rage. I was being sung all over.
Yeah.
So Jack McCrae, you know Jack McCrae was harrowing my grove that evening. So I called, I said, Jack, come and help me get this car out of here and get these books and things out of here. The ants are about to eat me up. And so he got them out, helped get them out, and I ran to the house or something, and when I came back, he stuck a match to those things. I said, Jack, don't do that. I said, let's get rid of the ants some way, but I don't want to, that's music. And I did salvage some of it.
Mm-hmm.
But he just saw scrap paper, I guess, too. So I lost some of it. I have near the collection that I did have because of that.
All you needed was just a little old can of chlorine.
Why, yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and
that.
I was going to get some insect spray, something, and spray the things you know around about.
Mm-hmm.
But Jack, after he got them out of there, well, I was going to have just for a minute to get something else. He struck a match here. But I was glad I went back and saved some.
What do you use for ant hills around the place?
I get some kind of white powder.
Yes, chlordane.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And
anyway, her home was the cultural center point of the,
mm-hmm.
of that area. Always open to any group or any committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that's a great contribution, it seems to
mm-hmm.
me. That's a remarkable thing.
And so I said, I've tried to let my home and my environment influence some people.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're waiting, they roam ahead, they know everything I have. And I don't care, I'm glad I'm still. I have it here for them to see.
Yes.
Because they come from a lot of homes that where they haven't anything like these.
That's right.
And I know, because I go to their home. And so they enjoy. And you know, it's something interesting. Everyone, I don't care who it is, every one of my children, one thing they're attracted by,
uh-huh.
I mean, they're good.
Oh, really?
Oh, well, I guess.
Yeah.
Often because it's a book or what? But they're all intrigued with these little books.
Yeah. What are they?
Well, it's just a miniature library. Now, this is here, Boston.
Oh.
And that is the coming of Arthur. This is the Holy Grail.
Hmm.
In a garden. These are given to me in 1923.
Yeah.
And they $100, Inner Garden and other poems.
Yeah. And they are fascinated with these little things.
I think they're kind of disappointed when they find nothing much that they care to read. But still, they're intrigued with these little books.
Yeah.
By Dumas.
Hmm. Gee whiz, that's a little of everything.
Inferno, Dante's Inferno.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something like that.
What sort of edition is that, does it say?
Little Leather Library Corporation.
That's what it calls it.
Short stories by Guy de Maupassant.
Mm-hmm. Boys would be influenced by the girls, wouldn't they?
Yes, mm-hmm.
And at home they don't see, I don't imagine they see furniture with much taste.
And they like mamata fish. They like mamata fish, the boys do.
Yeah.
Tell the daddies about it.
Yeah.
Sometimes they come here upstairs to pick up the... See, I like to see that, but I don't believe what that boy said that to me.
That's your grove?
Mm-hmm. That my father's hand, though, was before he was ever married. He was married in 1894.
Oh, really?
And there was a time when you couldn't see through that, such big trees. But beginning in 1959, along with that, we began having a lot of colds. And some of them looked like... It looked like I was going to lose them all. I did lose 8 or 9 or 10.
57 is the winter I came down here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, well, you know, I came from up country, and it seemed like it was
for pruning the groves. They had to prune them back so far until they called them hat racking the groves.
Yeah.
You know, when they got through, they wanted to leap on, here was an arm, here was an arm. And it was very expensive, calling it a hat rack in the grove. So mine, that out there looked like a hat rack.
You know, some of those old trees I've
seen at the corner of this block, and that's where he intended to build his house.
Yeah.
And before he could build the kind of house he wanted, this one was off for sale.
Oh, I see.
And it included this half acre, so he bought that, I mean, this half block.
Mm-hmm.
So then for years and years and years, he owned this three quarters of a block.
Uh-huh.
And then that one, that property down there was changing hands. And my father was a man who got along with most anybody. Somebody was going to buy that. A woman.
Mm-hmm.
Who has a reputation down here being very hard to get along with. He said, well, I'm not going to run the risk of having them there if I can't get along with it. I'll buy it myself. So he jumped in and bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have it. We owned the whole block then until after my mother died in 1940. I had the opportunity and I sold that quarter. So that brought me back the original three quarters of the block.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was the end of that little session with some very interesting points, but not what you'd call good talking. I cut out the visit with her students to hear the rehearsals of the London Symphony. Then I got to thinking about it. That circumstantial account of Tommy Berry learning to play in the garden seemed to bring to me so overwhelmingly the low charge the person has to work with in the little communities. I found it hard on me. And I just realized that I'd have to put in, I tried to cut it out, you know. I had to put in this visit to the London Symphony to balance Tommy Berry.
Yeah, how long it took me to get there?
Oh, yeah.
That was in the days when one would think about getting in the car and going driving to the town alone. And the bus connection was terrific. I think I left it between 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning. Went to Gainesville and changed buses. Went to Palatka and changed. And then came down to DeLand and changed. And then across to the town. It was about 5 o'clock when I got there. For the 12 hours. And then coming back the next day, the same thing. I left about the same time, made about the same schedule coming back. Now then you can drive over there an hour and a half.
You had a friend on it.
And do it alone. I do it alone. Think nothing of it.
Mm-hmm.
We went to a rehearsal of the London Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, to a rehearsal?
Uh-huh. And they charge almost as much to see them hear them rehearse as they do to the evening program.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I had been over the London Orchestra has been there 3 seasons. The first time they went, first time they were there, I met my friend in Jacksonville there, and we spent the night at the concert. Then the next year, at that time, I found out about their rehearsals in the morning. It was open to the public for a price. But I thought, I'd just like to see that. And it's rather expensive to go there and spend the night, and I couldn't drive back at night. So I thought, well, I'd love to hear them rehearse, and that's in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I went that next year and took these girls. They bought their own tickets, and I took them over. And so they, the men would come in to the rehearsal just from the beach, with the beach clothes on and sandals, and just, they were all English, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And just as informal as they could be.
Mm-hmm.
And finally the conductor came in and they got all tuned up and they got claxon. They never practiced anything all the way through, they just practiced the difficult part. And he stopped them, having to go over it again. And over and over and over, one little part. Finally he said, now, if we could all do that correctly at the same time, that would be something.
Now that's the end. I stuck in the little incident of visiting the
London Symphony. This is the end of that nice little visit right after church, when Lois was actually eating lunch way back there in her great big kitchen on Sunday, the 22nd of June, 69. Now, this is along about 660, Channel 1 right. This is the end of that little visit, the last part of it. I stuck it in after the telephone conversation with Flora to have it all together. And the first part of it is on Channel 1 over, right after that marvelous fine tape about her uncles. So this is the second part of it. It's continued from Channel 1 over to Channel 1 right. That's backwards. This is about 665, Channel 1 right, and the end of the little visit with Lois Dixon after church when she was trying to eat lunch in her big kitchen that Sunday, the 22nd of June, 69.